Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Design Defects and Preemption Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On June 24, 2013, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Mutual Pharmaceutical Company v. Bartlett. The question in this case was whether federal law preempts state law design defect claims targeting generic pharmaceutical manufacturers. In a 5-4 opinion, the court held that state law design defect claims that turn on the adequacy of a drug's warnings are preempted by federal law. The lower appellate court's opinion to the contrary was therefore reversed. Justice Alito delivered the opinion of the court, in which Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia, Kennedy, and Thomas joined. Justice Breyer filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justice Kagan joined. Justice Sotomayor filed a dissenting opinion, in which Justice Ginsburg joined. To discuss the case, we have Greg Dickinson, who is an associate at Harris Beach, LLP. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Dickinson.
Today I'll be discussing Mutual Pharmaceutical Company v. Bartlett. In that case, it slightly expanded preemption in the context of prescription drugs. As in many of the court's pharmaceutical cases, the plaintiff suffered horrific injuries after taking a drug that was manufactured by the defendant, Mutual Pharmaceutical. In 2004, Karen Bartlett went to her doctor with shoulder pain. She was prescribed Sulindac, a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory pain reliever. Soon after taking the drug, though, Bartlett developed a condition known as toxic epidermal necrolysis. 60% of her skin deteriorated, became like an open wound, and she spent months in a coma. She's now severely disfigured and blind. At the time she was prescribed the drug, though, its label didn't list this condition as a potential side effect. When she recovered, Bartlett sued the manufacturer, alleging that its failure to list the condition on the label was a design defect for which the company should be strictly liable. A New Hampshire jury agreed and awarded $21 million in damages. At both trial and later on appeal to the First Circuit, Mutual Pharmaceutical argued that this claim was preempted by FDA regulations. The FDA has issued very detailed requirements governing when and how drug manufacturers may modify drug labels. And the company argued that because these regulations prohibited it as a generic drug manufacturer from modifying the drug's label, the plaintiff's design defect claim was preempted by federal law. This is the third case in the last few years that the court has considered claims like this, considering whether state tort actions are preempted by FDA drug labeling regulations. And two prior cases were pretty central to the arguments of the parties in this case. First, in 2009, the court decided Wyeth v. Levine, where a plaintiff brought a failure to warn claim against Wyeth based on its labeling of the branded drug, Phenergan. Wyeth argued that the plaintiff's failure to warn claim was preempted by FDA regulations that ordinarily require approval prior to any label changes. But the court, in a 6-3 decision, allowed the plaintiff's claims to go forward. The court reasoned that even though FDA regulations ordinarily require FDA pre-approval, the regulations also do allow for unilateral label changes when those changes will improve drug safety. Because Wyeth could have changed its labels to warn of the risk, the plaintiff's failure to warn claim was not preempted by the FDA regulations. Just 2 years later, though, in Pleva v. Mensing, the court came to the opposite conclusion in a very similar case. In Mensing, the court found a failure to warn claim against generic drug manufacturer Pleva to be preempted. Unlike branded manufacturers, generic manufacturers are never permitted to change a drug's label, even if those changes would improve drug safety. The court reasoned that because it would have been impossible under FDA regulations for Pleva as a generic manufacturer to modify the label, those FDA regulations preempted the plaintiff's failure to warn claim. Following this decision, courts have almost universally found labeling claims against generic manufacturers to be preempted by FDA regulations. In this case, the plaintiff attempted to distinguish Mensing in two ways. First, she argued that because her design defect claim, unlike a failure to warn claim, is a strict liability offense, it didn't impose any duty on manufacturers. She argued that the law merely served to spread risk in drug manufacturing, and that because it merely spread risk and imposed no duties, it couldn't be inconsistent with federal law. Second, she argued that even if state design defect law did impose duties different from FDA regulations, it would have still been possible to comply with both. A manufacturer, she said, could avoid violating state or federal law if it simply stopped selling the drug altogether. In its decision, the court dismissed Bartlett's first argument pretty quickly. the court agreed with Bartlett that New Hampshire's design defect cause of action created strict liability, but it disagreed with Bartlett's argument that the law was purely compensatory and not regulatory. A manufacturer is liable under a design defect theory if it sells any product in a defective condition that is unreasonably dangerous to the user, even if it has exercised all reasonable care. The plaintiff in a design defect claim need not prove negligence, but the plaintiff must show that the product was unreasonably dangerous due to a lack of proper warnings or some other defect. Thus, the court reasoned, design defect claims do impose duties on manufacturers, a duty not to create unreasonably dangerous products. And if this duty, as applied, is inconsistent with federal law, it's preempted. So next, the court moved on to consider whether New Hampshire's design defect cause of action, as applied to prescription drugs, did conflict with the FDA regulations. When determining whether a product is unreasonably dangerous, New Hampshire courts consider the balance between the usefulness of the product and its risk of danger. If a product can be made more useful without increasing its risk, or less risky without affecting its usefulness, that suggests the product is unreasonably dangerous. But on the other hand, if a product can't be made more useful or less risky, it's not unreasonably dangerous. Now, in the drug context, usefulness and risk are primarily determined by the chemical composition of the drug, something that Mutual Pharmaceutical couldn't change here, because the FDCA requires generic drugs to be identical to their branded equivalents. The only way the company could have altered the drug's risk, the court reasoned, was by changing its label to warn for the risk of toxic epidermal necrolysis. But unfortunately, as a generic manufacturer, Mutual Pharmaceutical was prohibited by FDA regulations from changing the label, even though the changes may have improved the drug's safety. Because the design defect cause of action would have required the company to do something prohibited by FDA regulations, change the drug's label, the court found that compliance with both state and federal law would have been impossible, and that the claim was therefore preempted. Lastly, the court turned to this argument offered by the plaintiff in the First Circuit that compliance with both state and federal requirements was possible, that the company could have simply chosen to stop doing business in the state and therefore complied with both laws. The court had never addressed this argument before, but it found it to be dramatically inconsistent with its previous preemption decisions. The court reasoned that compliance with both state and federal law is always possible if you consider the possibility of not acting at all, but none of the court's previous decisions had required this dramatic step. Even the previous decision in Pliva v. Mensing had ignored this possibility. The court held in this case that a party is not required to cease acting altogether in order to avoid violating inconsistent state and federal laws. For generic drug manufacturers, this is another big win. The court reaffirmed its decision in Pliva that generic manufacturers can't be liable for tort claims involving drug labeling, and the decision confirmed that this logic applies not only to failure to warn claims, which explicitly invoke a product's labeling, but also to any claim that raises faulty labeling as its basis, even as here, implicitly. Here, even though the plaintiff alleged design defect generally and not a particular defect in the labeling, the court dug down and analyzed New Hampshire law to determine that the product's labeling was really at the heart of the claim. It was the only way that the defendant could have changed the risk of its product. This case also signals a continued expansion of the court's impossibility line of preemption cases. Historically, in most preemption cases where a statute lacks an express preemption clause, the court has relied on its obstacle preemption doctrine. Under the obstacle preemption doctrine, the court considers Congress's objectives when it passed a statute and asks whether state law stands as an obstacle to those objectives. But in 2009, Justice Thomas, in his Wyeth v. Levine concurrence, he announced that he planned to abandon the obstacle preemption doctrine. In his view, it was inappropriate and unconstitutional for courts to displace state law based on their perceptions of federal policy objectives. Instead, he argued, any displacement of state law should be either 1) express or 2) implicit based on impossibility of compliance with federal and state law. This doctrine of impossibility preemption has a lengthy history, but until 2009, the doctrine had been mostly dormant. Obstacle preemption covered everything impossibility preemption did, and then some, so the court didn't really have any need to rely on impossibility preemption. And even after Justice Thomas's 2009 concurrence in Wyeth, it wasn't clear where the doctrine was headed. Justice Thomas has set out on his own before without bringing other justices with him. It's now clear, though, that this time Justice Thomas has managed to bring the other conservative justices along. If the conservative justices want to assemble a majority, or if a litigant wants to sway 5 votes in a closely divided preemption case, they need Justice Thomas's vote to round out a 5-4 decision. And the only way to get that is to argue impossibility preemption. So in both Pliva v. Mensing and Mutual Pharmaceutical v. Bartlett, the party's arguments and the court's ultimate decisions have focused on impossibility preemption rather than obstacle preemption. It's now clear that as long as Justice Thomas remains on the court, and the court remains so closely divided, obstacle preemption will be a losing argument for defendants. Whether that really matters ultimately, though, is less clear. Asking whether compliance with state and federal law is impossible at least sounds like a pretty bright-line rule, much more so, at least, than asking whether state law is an obstacle to federal objectives. But, as applied in Mensing and now in Bartlett, impossibility preemption has produced the same 5-4 ideological splits as obstacle preemption did. Apparently, impossibilities aren't much easier to spot than obstacles. The one thing that is clear from these cases, though, is that if you want to argue preemption in the Supreme Court, you're going to need to find a way to convince Justice Thomas that compliance is impossible, not just an obstacle to federal policy.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.